Voting machines are totally hackable, but who's going to pay to fix them? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace Tech, Demystifying the Digital Economy. I'm Molly Wood. The midterm elections are here. Early voting is already happening in some places. So let's spend the rest of the week on election security and technology, starting with voting machines, aka
decrepit equipment that was never designed for the security threats that we have today.
That's Candace Hoke from the Center for Cybersecurity and Privacy Protection at the Cleveland Marshall College of Law. She believes insecure voting machines are the biggest security threat to the midterm elections, and they are definitely insecure. Last summer at the DEF CON hacking conference, security experts hacked and whacked at a variety of voting machines and came away saying the machines were hopelessly vulnerable to even the most basic hacking, like the kind where the default password is still password. And lots of machines don't even create paper receipts to ensure that votes are counted correctly. Oh, and by the way, the researchers said most of these problems have been known about for a decade.
We have not required voting systems vendors to operate under the same kinds of rules as, say, pharmaceuticals as to the safe and effectiveness of their products. So safety, privacy, auditability, transparency, whatever word you want to use, these are all marketing terms in the voting systems arena, rather than reflective of some kind of standards that are actually being enforced.
So here's the deal with standards. There is a federal process that tests and certifies these machines for accuracy, security, usability, and vote auditing. But it's up to states to decide whether they want fully certified machines. 38 states require at least one element of the certification program. Only 12 require the full federal certification. And 8 states, including Florida, New Hampshire, Oklahoma, and Montana, don't have any requirements at all. As for the vendors, Candace Hoke says they don't really have the money to build cutting-edge machines.
The vendors are actually making their money from the technical services they provide to local governments for conducting elections, and that's their steady stream of income. So many of them are, as far as we know, because they're privately held companies, are not doing very well. And so they certainly cannot really afford to invest in software development at the level that we, the public, would want.
Hoke proposes that voting infrastructure should be regulated and funded like a public utility.
The public utility model is one that we have used where the public is willing to trade certain kinds of protections for an industry in exchange for receiving certain kinds of guarantees from the industry itself. So, for instance, we could guarantee them a certain level of profit in exchange for being able to assure that the systems, the software is secure.
Don't hold your breath for any of that. It would take lots of money and an act of Congress. In the meantime, Hoke and other election security experts say the best thing states and cities can do is go back to paper ballots. Tomorrow, we'll look at a state election official who tried to design an open source voting machine with a paper trail. Two words, uphill battle. And now for some related links. There's been a lot of conversation about the amount of money from Saudi Arabia that's been poured into Silicon Valley companies through venture capital funds. Saudi Arabia is the biggest single source of SoftBank's now legendary $100 billion Vision Fund, and it's pledged $45 billion to the next Vision Fund. All eyes this week will be on who shows up at the Future Investment Initiative in Riyadh, the so-called Davos in the Desert. Yesterday, the website for the event was briefly taken down after someone hacked it and redirected visitors to images of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The site was back up by late afternoon. Other links, the San Francisco Chronicle had a good piece yesterday asking why doesn't Silicon Valley just give Saudi Arabia its money back and explaining how hard it is to disentangle from a big private deal. Short version is these companies can't afford it. Here's the other thing. That huge Vision Fund and the other venture capital funds that are trying to compete with it have created what feels like an endless pool of money for companies, even if some of it's, you know, blood money. So here's my question. What happens to the tech economy if suddenly all that money goes away? And what happens if instead it goes to places that aren't as worried about the source, like China, which is working on a tech economy to rival the U.S. by any means necessary. I am not arguing for taking the blood money, let's be clear. But I am saying that once you dance with the devil, it's real hard to get off that dance floor. I'm Molly Wood, and that's Marketplace Tech. This is APM. Sign up for our daily email newsletter by October 31st, and you could be in for a Halloween treat. We're giving away 10 treat bags filled with some great Marketplace swag, including our high-powered phone charger, a pretty cool gadget you cannot get anywhere else. Subscribe today at marketplace.org for your chance to win, and good luck.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.